There you go, you're back live. That was Backman Turner Overdrive. You're back live with Dr. Rock's radio show on msiradio.com, where, as far as I can tell, I'm joined live by Sunbird. Are you hearing me still at Sunbird?
I can indeed, yeah.
Very good, that's great. I forgot to press a button there all this time and I'm still not getting it quite right. There you go. Thanks very much for joining us on MSI Radio. I really appreciate it, mate.
No problem.
As I was saying earlier, although we've shared many fields together, this is our first real chance to chat.
Yeah, it's quite bizarre, really, that I'm talking to a computer on radio, but there we go.
There you go. I'll know a bit more about each other by the time we get out there next season.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I think that everybody could tell from the show we did from the Unity Gathering outside Glastonbury what a cracking time we were having there. How did it go for you? You look to be pretty chill with the whole thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's great, the fact that the concept that I've put forward seems to actually be grounding out, and people are getting the point of the fact that they co-own the event. It's a cooperative event where, by coming, you become a member shareholder. And so it's like a private members club or a mobile social club where everybody present co-owns the event itself. So, yeah, I'm quite pleased with myself, I must admit.
So did you find it easy to get people to take responsibility for their own presence and their own activities at a place?
Well, because it's not the way events of any sort are managed, people didn't really get it for the first two. And slowly, I think, the pennies dropped. And it only takes a few people to get the hang of it, and that creates an energy of understanding, you know, like the 100th monkey effect. And eventually people realize that, that it's their event. It's like their own house party, but in a field.
Yeah. So where did it all start? How long ago did you set about trying to get to the thing that we experienced in September?
Well, the first small event I did was the Earth Heart Transformation Camp, probably 12 years ago. And I've done all sorts of things with Sunrise and Waveform and big ones and small ones. And it was the experience of finding that people didn't have a sense of ownership and that there was massive financial risk. And so my birthday was on the Venus Transit, which was the first of the TLC events. And I felt obliged to do an event for the Venus Transit. And so I had to think outside of the box because I was risk averse, having lost lots of money and other people's money and struggled, to be honest with you, with setting up large events that failed to, that worked financially in some ways, but not financially as far as being able to pay everybody. You know, energetically they were fantastic. And so, yeah, so then I came up with the concept of a cooperative event. And it's only taken 12 years and about 40 events of one sort or another to get it cracked. But there you go, it's all back to basics, and small is the key. I think that's the secret.
I think you're absolutely right there. I made the decision myself a couple of years ago that small gigs was what I wanted to do. I enjoyed the larger festivals whilst I was doing them, but really in the end, I must admit, it was the branded security that put me off. It just seemed as much as anything else like walking into a prison camp.
Yeah, well, I mean, half the problem there is to fulfil the licence conditions, you have to have a huge quantity of security, whereas for the type of events that you and I would go to, they're self-regulating. So really, we only need one or two people to manage anything if it gets out of hand. We don't need 30 or 40 security guards. And the problem is they get bored. And when they're bored, they get mischievous. And then things can get out of hand simply through boredom or through wanting something to happen. You know, I mean, it sounds crazy, but if you've got 40 security guards with nothing to do, it's actually a problem.
Yeah, they become insecurity guards.
Well, they certainly don't help the vibe. That's unfortunate. But I mean, you know, again, the thing with the cooperative model is that we're deemed capable of managing ourselves. So, which obviously we are capable of.
It was certainly my impression that at the Unity Gathering that had anything occurred, people, more or less everybody I came across would have been happy to step up to the plate and help deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, although, you know, we did have a couple of SIA security, because these days you're not legally allowed to manhandle anybody off of a site unless you've got a registered security number, believe it or not. But it's a matter of prevention rather than cure, you know. So in many ways, if you provide the right space, you call in the right people.
Yeah, I certainly didn't see any SIA security. Where were you keeping them?
Oh, down by the gate.
Right. Yeah, under the watchful eye of Vicky. I guess it makes a lot of difference, doesn't it? People are so used, I think, to paying for things and turning up and having everything done for them. It's a very different model, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, the other thing is, basically, it's back to the concept of a free party where you take what you expect to find and you join in, but in a way that fits with the modern paradigm where we've got to fit into the respectability of being able to deal with the councils and be officially present, but at the same time self-responsible. And so, you know, it's great the fact that at the end of each event we have a meeting and we talk about what it is that we need to bring to the next event. And you know, we're open to feedback from people. And for instance, at the last one, we've decided we need a proper jamming music stage, a live jamming music stage. And so, because the event is by the people, for the people, it's our job to make sure that that happens. You know, and if other things get identified, then the role of the stakeholders, of the coordinators, is to make sure that we fulfil the needs of the people that come.
Because that's, I mean, talking about cost and risk and the rest of it, sticking on a live music stage is quite an additional responsibility to be taking on, isn't it, really?
It is, but I think, I was talking to someone the other day about it, and basically I think as long as we get a decent PA and someone to stage manage that can manage the sound quality, then we can rely a lot on the musicians that come anyway, and then we can invite some other musicians to come in exchange for just expenses and a plus one for their partners, because it's that type of event. And because they get fed in the evening everywhere with the communal meal, it makes it possible, you know, that we'll call in some amazing talent, and it can be spoken word, it can be all sorts of things I can imagine coming forwards. And even if it's not full to the brim on the first event, you can guarantee it the second one it will be.
I think that's the thing. It's like, so I remember reading a book years ago on marketing, and it said that you can spend really as much time as you like advertising, but nearly all of your trade's going to come through word of mouth and repeat trade.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's part of the reason for creating it as a membership, is that obviously we keep in regular touch with newsletters to everybody that's ever come. And whether they're a paid-up member or they've just come and their membership's elapsed, they still get to hear about the gatherings. And because it's new and it's breaking out of the mould, the feeling that I've got is that people are resonating with it. And it's not everybody's cup of tea, but I get the feeling that by having regular events, we'll get a lot of repeat business from people. Business is the wrong word to use, but repeat attendance. And that they'll want to bring their friends, you know, and it's never going to be an expensive commercial event. So it in this time when money's a bit tight, it's a really good, you know, opportunity. And, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm confident it's going to grow to the point where we've built into the growth projection that instead of making the event too big, we're going to split it into two at the end of next season. And we're going to have regional events. So the second one will either be near London or Wales. We haven't decided yet.
Oh, that sounds really great. I think the idea of getting bands in for expenses and an extra ticket and stuff, that we've got a very small local festival out in Mid Wales. I think it was in its third year this year, and I interviewed several of the bands that came along this year, and they had a really cracking time. And also they it's It's one of the few gigs I've been to where I've actually been seen dancing to like five bands in a row. Really extraordinary quality. And I guess we can hope, it being with the cooperative model, we can reasonably hope, can we not, that what we're going to get, what we're going to attract, is people who want to take part as well as people who want to attend.
That's right. I mean, that is the whole point, really, is that everybody's got something they can bring, even if it is to be the audience, you know, or to do the dancing or the participant in the workshops. But we want to try and encourage people to realise they can be more than that, you know, and that everybody's got their talents and their special gifts to give. And so we're hoping to develop a way of actually trying to key into people's latent talents and get them to kind of express them, you know, at these gatherings.
I think that's really exciting because, as I said to you earlier, I used to really enjoy the Stonehenge Free Festival. And although it was pretty much anarchic, especially towards the end when it really got quite big, I mean, I never had any idea how many people were there, but it did seem to me that the vast majority of people that came along did bring something with them. So the place was full of little impromptu stages and people with puppets and on stilts and jugglers and fireworkers, and it was just alive, you know, two or three fields full of people. And that also, although it was big, it policed itself. It actually dealt with some fairly large insurgent problems in the end, but they were dealt with. I remember the Here and Now band once saying that they got a bit of problem on the main drag. I think some Hell's Angels had turned up and were causing a whole lot of trouble. And basically the audience moved itself from the stage, saw to the Hell's Angels, and then came back to the Here and Now band. It was really cracking to see, and that was years ago. It's great to imagine that we can start seeing that kind of spirit back again.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, in so many ways, it's how it's always been. If you imagine the old gatherings hundreds of years ago, the tribal gatherings, people would have come with what they had to bring. That was it, whether it was food or talents or whatever, you know. And the summer gatherings were a chance to kind of hang out with people that you hadn't seen for ages and have some fun.
Yeah,
and it's all become so commercial and controlled that they're kind of squeezing the fun out of it, which is, you know, pretty off, really, when you consider that most people's lives are kind of forced into a mould, you know. And the great thing about festivals and gatherings is that you can break out of your mould and you can really set yourself free for a weekend, you know. And so I suppose anything that helps that is what I'm into, you know. And that's what's inspired me over the years, is that actually sometimes at events you get the chance to have experiences that you might never have. And they can be awakening opportunities. You know, you can leave an event different to when you've arrived. You know, you can actually go home different and make different choices and decisions, you know.
Yes, and that changes life when you leave the place as well. I was flying high, I was, for quite some time after I left the Unity Gathering. And isn't it, I mean, I think it was a major realisation for me that one of the ways of making these gatherings or festivals more fun for myself was actually to be taking part, was actually to have a role and to be doing some work.
Yeah, well, a good balance of work and play seems to be the mature way of getting involved, because there's something about, you know, the give and take of it, that by putting energy in, what you get back somehow is tenfold, you know, and it's not always direct. And so if you can get a few hundred people putting energy in, the effect is actually, the thing is very buoyant. And there was, I think something that happened at the last Unity Gathering was that the energy was tangible, even for people that weren't very sensitive. There was a tangible sense that we'd created something and that we were in it. And I think it was summed up by a conversation I had. And obviously I go to 8 or 10 events all through the summer, and normally I call them the gathering of the tribes. It's tribes of people, small groups of people coming from all over to one place. But at the Unity Gathering, it felt like the gathering of our tribe, that actually we were creating a family or a tribe of people that actually relate to each other and that are pooling their energy and resources. And so it was like we're creating a new tribe, you know, based on the concept of unity. And so, you know, what better than that? A sense of belonging is something that I've yearned for, you know, since I was a teenager.
Yes, I agree. I've always wanted to live in community, something that I haven't managed to do yet, but I am definitely feeling that communities are being established, albeit for short times in fields. And it, I mean, how much work went in? You must have been pretty busy for the rest of the summer. How much work actually went into getting the cooperative together and giving it the shape it needed to make it seem so easy once we got into the field?
Well, in all honesty, the cooperative was founded in the end of 2011. And as I say, the concept behind it was the heading towards doing the first event of the season. Background noise there. And so I just gathered people from my festival background and encouraged the ones that I knew would want to take part to get it together. But I put quite a lot of driving energy into it in the first one. And to some extent, the second one that happened in the spring of this year. And then the autumn one, because I was away on tour all summer, I said at the end of the autumn one, which was our AGM, so we voted in some new directors, and we voted, did we want to do an event at the end of the year? And there was a resounding yes. And I said, well, I can't produce it because I'm busy all summer. I've been off on tour to Germany and Switzerland. And this is, you know, it's one of eight or nine events that I did this year. And so Greg stepped forward and said, okay, well, I'll produce it. You know, so he took my role, if you like, as the main event producer, because he was staying in Britain. And so that actually initiated the start of a growing of the core team, because he brought lots of new people in. The people that I'd brought in were all, you know, were still there. And by the end of the summer, at the meeting that you came to, you know, we had a good 15 people that are committed to making sure these events are going ahead. And the, you know, the amazing thing for me is I know that if I walked away from the cooperative tomorrow, that I, not that I would, of course, but if I did, that it's going to carry on without me. And that's absolutely fantastic. You know, that's actually, it means that I've overcome my attachment to being the person that drives it, if that makes sense. It really is a cooperative.
Yeah, it is. I think it's the first time I've ever seen you actually wandering around looking chill, rather than either working or asleep.
Yeah, well, it does take a lot of energy to hold it together. And you know, and people often say that the organizing events for alternative types is like herding cats. And it's quite time consuming trying to get things moving in the right direction. But yeah, it certainly feels like it's happening. And I'm, interestingly enough, now that I've found that tribal love has found its feet, it seeded another project that I'm calling HOME, which stands for Honour Our Mother Earth. And it's taking some of the things that I've learned from TLC, from the Tribal Love Cooperative, and putting it into a framework that's capable of a lot bigger outreach. But I'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, that sounds interesting. It seems to me that one of the reasons why the unity was successful, and I saw it, another small festival that we like to go to is called Fire in the Mountain, which happens out near Aberystwyth. And it's, I think last year it was kind of 400 or 500 people. This year it got 1,000. But one of the things they did differently this year was they empowered individuals to take responsibility for a given section. It might be the healing field. It might have been they have a kind of, what they call a Chad Academy, which is a workshop yurt. They've got saunas. And what effectively was done was individuals took responsibility for a given area and then made sure that they had the team necessary to make it the best they could. And they weren't thinly spread, you know, they weren't distracted from their main target. And my impression of the unity was that that's what had happened there, that there was, I don't know, maybe 12.5 people who were kind of like core members who had other strong people helping them out.
Yeah, well, I think that's definitely the way nature would do it. You know, it's all about diversification and then specialization. And so, again, people are stepping forwards that are passionate about things. So, you know, if someone doesn't want to do anything, you know, there's been a couple of people that have said, oh, I can't do that anymore. The last thing we want is for people to do something that they don't feel they really want to with all their heart. Because if they do, I'm a great believer that they're blocking someone else that would take that place and love to do it. You know, whether it's the washing up or, you know, or managing a stage. And so, because now we've had a few events under our belt, you know, the people are finding their place within it. And, yeah, I mean, it can only go from strength to strength as far as I'm aware. You know, it's just all one step at a time, but, it, you know, it's definitely got a good feeling about it.
I think if nothing else, it's really great for, because, I mean, life seems to be so humdrum nowadays. It's just really great to be giving people the opportunity to make a difference by being there, really, to make a difference by when working as part of a team is something else. I think that divide and rule seems to be one of the basic tools being used against us, as it were, and offering and enabling the opportunity for people to work together and see how much greater the thing is than just the sum of its parts is really useful.
Yeah, well, it certainly gives a sense of hope, you know, and the long-term goal is, you know, to own the land upon which we celebrate so that we can put infrastructure in and build gardens and have a healing temple and things like that, you know. So who knows? I mean, the sky's the limit. And I'm a great believer in you've got to do what you can do. You know, there is a lot of problems in the world. And if I play my small part in the divine plan and I do the best that I can and I start to overcome some of my weaknesses, you know, and put my best foot forwards, then I kind of give everybody else around myself in the world permission to do the same. And so, you know, that's all we can do is live by example, really.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Well, I certainly look forward to more of it myself. Hopefully I'll get to work a bit harder at the next one. As you know, I've been doing the Avalon Rising thing, but I think I'm probably going to get involved in the toilets next time. That's always a thing that needs approaching.
Well, everybody's got to use them. There's not a choice with the toilets.
No, it's true. And wouldn't it be great to be able to work away from having the port-a-loos?
Well, I mean, they're a last resort, you know, and we have used compost toilets a lot. But we were worried about the attendance numbers at the last one and our budgeting. And we've managed through being really careful with the budget to make a profit on all the events except for the first one. So, you know, that's quite unheard of for little festivals, really. They often lose money.
Yeah, that's certainly quite an achievement. And do you think we're getting any close? Because obviously access to land to grow veg should be a pretty simple desire, shouldn't it, really? But it's proved to be a major challenge. Do you think we're getting closer to seeing that happen?
Well, interestingly, I'm in negotiation at the moment, talking to some people that have bought a 30-acre old golf course and want to turn it into an ecological project. So it could be just around the corner. And, you know, who knows? I mean, I think if we're clear enough about what we want and there is a group energy, I think we can manifest anything.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And I don't know about you, but I feel that that there is a real feeling of change now, that it's almost as if the kind of pressure we're under is, well, there's always a balance in things, isn't there? And so there's going to be a shining of the light to balance the shadow that's being brought to bear.
Yeah, well, I think people know what they want, and as long as you get clear on it, you can have it. And so, you know, there is a lot of desire to grow food and live in community, so I'm sure we'll see more of that manifesting.
And in a way, it seems to me that there's lots of technologies manifesting that would make that a lot easier. You know, it isn't now so necessary to have yourself attached to mains electricity or mains sewage or all of that. I mean, permaculture, just as one school of thought, is yielding loads and loads of potential solutions to things that would have been very difficult problems to deal with, say, 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
We were using generators and stuff, weren't we, at the Unity? Do you think was there much power being generated that way?
Well, it was a mixture. There was some solar running into the earth heart, and I mean, I've used a mixture of solar and generators over the years, and the challenge can be that if it's sunny, no problem, but if you get an overcast period, then it can actually cause, you know, quite a challenge with solar energy.
Yeah. So I guess you've got to have the backup and pray for the weather.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, a mixed-use power provision, and obviously, you know, what with sound systems and lighting and all sorts of things, it is quite a tricky balance. But ideally, you know, I mean, we'll learn to be more efficient and, you know, have the generators as a backup rather than the first port of call.
Yeah, because they can be used to charge. If nothing else, if you've got enough battery power, they can be used to charge the batteries, can't they, in the absence of enough light?
Yeah, we've done that in the past. Just run them at night when we've needed the extra lighting and then turn them off in the early hours during the day. You know, so there are ways around it. And I think that somebody was actually wanting to do an energy audit and focus on how we can be more efficient. And again, it's one of those things that, you know, through practice, we can get better and better.
Yeah. I thought that one of the things that really struck me about the Unity Gathering that I thought, and I know a lot of other people would agree with this, that was a real success, was the business of getting everybody into a single tent to eat in the evenings. Those were absolutely vast pots of really, really fantastic food. I mean, how much difficulty did that present?
Well, I mean, I've been part of the Rainbow thing in the past, which has fed loads of people. And when we were deciding what was going to be different about these gatherings to other ones, we realized that community, one of the things that builds community is eating together. And also, it makes events affordable, that somehow when you've got one meal a day and you know it's going to be a decent meal in the evening, you can live on almost nothing. You can have a few cornflakes in the morning or whatever, you know, and have one proper meal a day. And if you are short of resources, then it makes the whole thing so much easier. And it also deals with the fact that everybody eats from the same pot. So there's no crew food. The crew food is the same as a communal meal. And fortunately, I've got a huge kitchen and some amazing chefs. And so, you know, I mean, it was a guy called Sky joined in with us this year for the autumn one. And he's trained with Egon Rone and, you know, is a top kind of five-star chef. And he, as you say, he was just making the most amazing food for 300 people, 250, 300 people at one, you know.
And you're right about that. You're right about the fact that if you're going to get a decent meal in the evening, then the rest of the day can more or less see to itself. But I mean, the cafe had some really great food coming out of it as well.
Yeah, well, that's amazingly. I offered to from the start to give half the profit from the cafe into the festival because I didn't want to be seen as profiteering. You know, even though most of the equipment was mine and all of that for, you know, the tents and things. And so, amazingly, half the profit just about covered the cost of all the vegetables and gas we needed to cook the communal meals. So the cafe paid for the communal food.
That was brilliant. And did you have a kind of menu planned out, or did you just get what you could afford and then the chef did what he could with it?
Well, there was a... To some extent, it's the last event of the season, so he did adapt to what we had in the larder, but we had quite a lot of food left over, you know, from the season, a lot of dried foods and things, and daily deliveries of vegetables. So, you know, he did pretty much do it on the cuff, just one day ahead.
Brilliant. And how much of the stuff was sourced locally?
Well, I mean, all the dried food and things like that was organic, because that's what I always buy with the Earth Heart. There were some local vegetables and things, and the rest of it came from a local fruit and vegetable wholesaler, which unfortunately a lot of that stuff does come from outside of the country, just because of the nature of what's grown commercially. But again, I think that's something we could improve upon, you know, over time, especially if we stick to using the same site.
That's very much a key thing, isn't it? Is finding somewhere where you can, because if you're constantly moving around, it's very difficult to develop local relationships.
Although there's been some talk about trying a different site from the point of view of not wanting to get stuck and too reliant on one place, you know, relationship with the landowner. We don't want it to feel as though we're obliged to go there or they're obliged to have us. I think we want to break out of that mould, certainly until such times as we might own the land. But again, we're just going with the flow and we're going to see what comes up. You know, we want people to get used to the idea that they can go here or there. It's the people that matter, not the place.
Yeah, and I guess it's a matter of we don't want to move on from old habits just to form new ones.
Well, humans are creatures of habit, aren't they? You know, and I think that it's very difficult to avoid that. But that actually, if we're clever, we'll change enough that we keep it interesting.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I mean, one of the ways that's going to happen is by attracting more people, new talent, different approaches. And as you say, by listening to what it is that people want and trying to provide it.
Yeah. And potentially moving it around a bit so that you go to a new area, which means you encounter new people.
Yes. Yeah. Make it more of a kind of travelling circus, like.
Kind of. I don't. That might be the extreme of it, and I suppose to some extent that's what the Earth Heart is. You know, my event space that I travel around, and that's. I'm hoping that's going to carry a bit more of a message with it in the coming season. But TLC, I mean, the dream for TLC is to find its, you know. Find its roots for a hub place and then have satellite events that grow off of it so that it doesn't grow too big, but that we can actually plant some vegetables and, you know, imagine in the communal meal, even if we just ate our own garlic.
Yeah.
Your meal, it would just be the turning of the tide, you know, to have something that we've grown ourselves.
Yes, it's true. And we went to visit a community recently, not far from here. And they had onions hanging everywhere. They'd apparently grown 3,600 onions last year.
Well,
just pretty amazing thing to do, because I mean they haven't got a huge amount of land, but they're clearly, I mean, that I think that's a great thing too. The idea that we could start supplying some of our own vegetables is really great.
Yeah, well, I'm sure actually if we put our mind to it, we could plant them at the spring event and harvest them in the autumn event.
Yeah. So another thing that's impressed me about the TLC, first of all, is that it's a cooperative, because I've looked into means of incorporation before, and it seems that it is the only way of really doing things, sharing responsibility. And I know there's, you know, behind what looks like a pretty informal event in a field, there is actually quite a formal structure necessary, isn't there, to make it legally existent, as it were.
Yeah, well, a cooperative is limited liability, which means that should anything go terribly wrong, it's liable for itself rather than an individual is liable. And it was the best model when I looked at it for this type of thing, because we've got what's called a multi-stakeholder model, which means that the people that actually make it happen, which is numbers about 15 at the moment, you know, of core coordinators, have half of the vote, and then all the other members, which are about another 900, have the other half of the vote. And what this means is that the people that actually do the organising can't be outvoted by people that don't have a clue about what's involved, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it means that, you know, we've got a mechanism for being able to manage it. And, you know, I think we're gonna have a shares issue at some point, you know, to raise some money towards, you know, this land idea. And, you know, everybody is a shareholder anyway by virtue of having bought a ticket and become a member. And so it's just a matter of investing and getting a few more shares, and that gives us some working capital.
Yeah.
You know, with that, we, you know, off we go.
Has there been a lot of voting yet?
Well, we have our AGM in the spring event. And so the first AGM was in May of this year. And then at the stakeholder meetings, you know, we do a bit of voting. And it's great, you know, because we just say, okay, we propose this, and you have a show of hands, and it's either yes or no, and that's it, you know. And we've done quite well so far. I know it can be a pain in the neck, but so far we've had a lot of agreement, you know. We have, you know, we decided not to have a bar, for instance. You know, it's something that kind of almost automatically comes to events, but there was this sense of, no, you know, if people want to have a drink, they can bring their own. Let's not encourage it. And so we voted about, you know, the sale of alcohol and decided not to.
Yeah. That was one of the things I found most challenging, I must admit, about that first Earth Heart thing. I was wondering what it was going to be like to be without beer for a few days. It didn't do me any harm, though. And actually, again, you know, I like maybe a bottle of beer in the evening, but I found the Unity thing so stimulating and enjoyable that I really didn't notice the lack of, I actually didn't notice the lack of a bar, in fact.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And the fact is that if you want to have a drop of wine or, you know, as you say, a beer in the evenings, no one's saying no. It's just that it's not under your nose so that people are getting drunk.
Mm. Yeah, which in itself actually really helps. So, but another thing that has struck me, you sent me a copy of the updated mission statement for the society, which I think it's a real, really brilliant example of simplicity and something that's easy to remember. Do you want us to, have you got a copy of it in front of you? Do you want to take us through its the main point?
I could have a copy of it in front of me. Give me a second. It's here somewhere.
Yeah, because it's that's another thing that I think is really helpful is that I keep getting given documents to read that are kind of like 270 pages long and stuff, and I'm wondering whether it's absolutely necessary that they're all there. And in fact, I was really struck by the simplicity of the, I mean, obviously they're complex aims, but they're simply stated so that people stand some chance of remembering them and working to them. And you've got, you've managed to acquire somebody who's got a bit of specialty in this sort of thing, haven't you? You're telling me about him earlier.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a guy called Gary used to work, for Nokia doing exactly what he's helping us with, which is, you know, just making sure that people knew exactly what it was that they were supposed to be doing in a funny kind of way. And, yeah, in fact, I'm looking for it on my computer here while I'm talking and not having much success.
Here we go. I've managed to get it up on mine. So I've got,
maybe you can read it out. But yeah. I mean, obviously I know what the original, some objectives and mission statement were, because there was a group of six of us that started it all in the first place.
Yeah.
And we were helped by Cooperatives UK. We had a guy come and give us some advice as to how to, you know, to structure things.
That sounds like an interesting group.
Oh, it was amazing. You know, we took 6 months of talking about it in order to actually ratify the cooperative. It was quite a long-winded process.
Yeah. Well, it looks like what you kicked off with was four aims and three objectives, and they've been marvellously distilled into two aims. The first of which is to develop the membership of the tribe towards self-sufficiency by acquiring land upon which we can work together in a variety of creative ways to celebrate life and to live.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant.
I think there isn't anybody that has been at the Unity Gathering that wouldn't have joined in with that, you know.
Well, it's such a, you know, it's such a, that's, it's only 1.5 lines long, that sentence, but, I mean, if we look at self-sufficiency, we tend to think about things like energy and food, but actually it's self-sufficiency in the whole thing, isn't it? It's in welcoming people and in maintaining the site and in, feeding people, and self-sufficiency is a marvellous idea, but it's quite a big phrase in this context.
Absolutely that, yeah. No, I think there's, as I say, he's put it quite succinctly, but there's an awful lot of work to pull that off, you know. Owning the land, running it, creating community, educating ourselves, becoming self-sufficient, supporting each other. That's, you know, mentally, physically, spiritually, education, kids, food, whoo.
Yeah, that's another thing. The kids seem to be really happy there. I didn't hear a single adult raised voice, and all I saw was bundles of children having a good time together. It was lovely.
Yeah, well, obviously, as a family, you know, some of them are going to be small people rather than just big ones.
Yeah, and I like work together in a variety of creative ways as well, because it blurs the distinction between work and play, and I always feel that with a mate of mine, Litmus, I feel that really the proper work should be a matter of play, really. It should be what we want to do and what we feel like doing.
Well, the more you enjoy it, the more likely you are to be good at it, I believe.
Yeah, and do you find that, you know, obviously the thing has pretty much a life of its own, do you find your kind of attracting the people that you need as you go along? They're turning up kind of as if by magic.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I work anyway, is I kind of energetically create a concept and then I start talking to people and putting it out there. And something that I learned to do some time ago is to hand it over to the divine, because if it's divine will, it's going to happen anyway. And if it isn't divine will, then who wants to do it?
Yeah.
So somehow, you know, by handing it over, it takes the need to try and force anything together out of it. I can naturally just let things happen, but put my energy in. You know, it's not like I've got to sit back with my feet up. But by generating energy, I create waves of change, and those waves bring people in and they make new things happen.
And doesn't that, I mean, that really does suggest that if we can encourage more of that kind of attitude and more of that kind of behaviour, then we could see waves of change running wider, really, through the whole thing.
Absolutely. I mean, who knows what the future holds? And if we can get a sense of how we want to live together, then we can manifest it.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that's possibly one of the things that we're being majorly distracted from, you know, as a population or as a society or whatever the correct collective term is. But I think maybe people don't have time to notice that it's what they're putting their intent on that is manifesting. It's not happening to them, it's happening because of them.
Yeah, well, that's, unfortunately, we're stuck with a media that's obsessed with bad news. And it's controlled by people that haven't got our best interests at heart. So, you know, short of disconnecting from the media, I mean, I don't have a television and I rarely read newspapers. You know, I do interact with things on the internet, but I try not to focus too much energy on what I don't want to happen. Because if I give energy to what I don't want to happen, guess what?
Yeah.
That I don't want happens. And so I try and, you know, focus on positive things and things that I believe are going to make a difference, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm tremendously encouraged by the number of people I come across nowadays who don't read newspapers and who don't have a television. It was quite a rare thing a decade ago. It's becoming a lot more common now.
Yeah.
And the people I know who don't have televisions are, I think, by and large, happier than the people that do. Not exclusively, but by and large.
Well, it's hard to be happy if you're just told terrible things are happening. How can you be happy about it? You know,
It's true, and I think it gets even more baffling once you find out that most of the terrible things they're telling you are happening are in one sense or another, more or less a complete fabrication.
Well, yeah, it's difficult to know what you can believe these days.
Yeah. So celebrating life and living it, that's the end of that point one, which is another thing I think that's, you know, there's so many of the things that are celebrated, be it, you know, Valentine's Day or Christmas or the Easter Bunny, or all of these things are also things that are, I don't know, they're kind of, everybody's celebrating all at the same time, and it nearly always involves spending a lot of money, whereas actually celebrating life in the moment with the people we're living with is so much easier and cheaper and so much more fun.
It's true. Yeah, but obviously that's not good business, so, you know, they're not going to be encouraging that.
No, it's true.
You know, unfortunately, you know, the world's being run like it's a business, and, you know, the truth is that the world is present for pleasure and enjoying it. You know, like there's a goddess charge that said, all acts of love and pleasure are my worship. You know, that is the point of life, is to enjoy it, is to, you know, wake up and enjoy the day and spend time, you know, with people that you love. And I believe that happiness is actually relationships, relationship with yourself, relationship with your friends and family, relationship to spirit, relationship to the earth. You know, it's all about relationships. If you've got good relations, then you can be happy, you know.
Yes, and how else do you find out about yourself other than in those relationships?
Well, absolutely. It's all a mirror, isn't it? You know, yeah. Whether we like it or not. And, you know, a lot of what the problem is with mainstream society is there's a lack of self-acceptance.
Yes, yes, indeed. And perhaps also a constant need to seek approval from outside.
Yeah. You know, trying to find happiness on the outside and contentment on the outside. You know, if you look in the wrong place, you're never going to find what you're looking for.
No. So that's aim one of the two aim mission statement. It's really great. I really love it. I love its brevity. And point two kicks off with create sustainable events that support personal responsibility and growth. I think personal responsibility is another key thing. It's obviously one of the main differences between the setup at the Unity and, say, the setup at the Secret Garden Party, where there doesn't seem to be any personal responsibility at all.
Yeah, well, I'd say they're probably opposite ends of the extreme, those two events that you talked there. But, yeah, at the end, you know, responsibility, the ability to respond. So it's not like it's a burden. It's actually helping people realise that they are these magnificent creatures that can, if they apply themselves, actually create something even better just by being present and adding their energy.
Yes, yeah. And that's another thing. It was right from the word go, from the moment we entered the gate there, it was apparent that people were responsive, that you could safely meet the eyes of anybody that you were coming across in the field and know that there was going to be a loving welcome and open conversation and, you know, we call it friendly advice and encouragement. It was really great. It's such a relief, if nothing else.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's definitely starting to work, that's for sure. You know, that is obviously, you know, what we've set out to do is create something where people can feel that they're a part of it and that it's a safe space to just be who you are, you know.
Yeah. And developing our potential to live together in harmony. This is another thing that I've noticed in the world about me is that people tend, it seems that many of the people around me, their default is to be not harmonious.
Yeah. Oof. That's a big one though, isn't it? You know, because it's difficult to, know other people because we can only see them through our own eyes, like through our own lens. And so, you know, I mean, I feel quite blessed that I'm able to be mild-mannered and courteous and filled with love and acceptance. And, you know, most of the time, but I haven't had the experiences that a lot of people have had that make them angry and frustrated, you know. So, and I, you know, I mean, I look at kids these days, teenagers, and I think, my God, it must be really tough to be growing up in an age where all the mainstream is telling you that it's all going down the pan, that the, if it's not the money, it's the climate, it's the government, it's everything is just rubbish, you know. And so it must be frustrating. It's no wonder they're doing all sorts of crazy stuff, you know.
Yeah, yes, yeah, I agree. And again, of course, the television really doesn't seem to help that. But the, it seems to me that one of the main things is for me anyway, one of the main realizations in relaxing me a bit was that everything tends to be okay in the moment. Nothing, I mean, I've had some pretty exciting times, and although, you know, I guess sometimes they are a little difficult to deal with, most of the difficulties come from me anticipating things that might happen as a result of the moment rather than the moment I'm living in.
Oh, well, there we go. That's, you know, as you say, most fear is actually outside of the moment. It's fear about something from the past or something in the future. And as you say, when you stop yourself in the track, you take a couple of deep breaths, you realise actually you're all right.
Yes.
And it's this obsession with something might happen.
Yeah.
Something is happening. It will happen, you know. And the, again, if you, the more you go for your fears and you go with anxiety, then that's what you're going to manifest. So, you know, it really is important to come back to the now and enjoy it, you know, and live today literally like it is your last day, and you forgive yourself for the past and you kind of embrace the future and do your best to make good decisions, you know, because that's the thing is that, that makes us different from animals is the fact that we can make decisions about the future, whereas all animals are living in the moment. They don't have any thought about what they're going to do next week, you know, and it's the challenge of humans to kind of get back to that in some ways.
And we do learn so much from challenge, don't we, from the difficult times.
Oh, yeah.
And like it says in the like it says in the I Ching, it says no plane not followed by a slope, but I prefer no slope not followed by a plane.
Yeah, right, fair enough. And I always remember thinking that I would perhaps become enlightened in this lifetime when I was young. And there's been a few times where I feel like I've been climbing the mountain of my reality. And I, just when I thought I've got to the top, I kind of look over the edge and it, as you say, there's the plateau. Just there's the mountain. It's like, oh God, you know. And of course that never ends until death, you know, that life is the journey. It's not a destination. And, you know, all we can do really is just make the most of it and really, you know, embrace the opportunity to make a difference. That's part of where I'm at. It's like, you know, focusing on the little things that I can do. If I find something that I think can make a difference on a bigger scale, and then put my energy into that, you know, and just trust that there's millions of people doing the same thing all over the planet, and that is in the end going to be what makes a difference.
Yeah. Yes. My friend Synchro, she frequently insists on concentrating on small, achievable tasks.
Yeah, well, if you think too big, then you can get put off.
Yeah.
You think, well, that's never going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, or it's just far too difficult. And then before you know it, you've talked yourself out of it. You know, and that's no good, is it? I mean, what, you know, what's the point in that?
Yeah, quite so. Shall we have a quick chat about the Earth Pound and then have a bit of a, then perhaps have a bit of a music break?
Yeah, well,
because the Earth Pound is one of the most interesting things. I was really thrilled to be able to handle a new currency when I came to that meeting at Burrow Mump. Well, and I know nothing about it at all apart from what it looks like. What's the idea there?
Well, it's a mixture of things. It was inspired initially is by the fact that we wanted to have our own currency so that we were ensured of being abundant. Because by limiting ourselves to the Queen's pound, then that can limit the abundance, you know. And as long as we've got a flow of tokens, then we can encourage abundance. But it was actually Greg's idea to, whereas the English pound used to be backed by gold, to have a currency that is actually backed by land. And so for every disc that's issued that's worth a pound, it actually is related to a small square of land that actually exists. And then on that land, we either have celebrations or we grow food. And so as we float the currency, we've got 8,000 discs that we bought. As we float that currency, we'll have the money to buy the bit of land that the currency relates to. So that will forever be held in perpetuity. So if we've got 8,000 discs in circulation that can be used within the events or in between people that are members, then that then is the mechanism by which we have the land upon which that we can call a homeland. So we've got somewhere where we can actually go. You know, so you can turn up literally with a dozen pound, earth pound coins in your hand and go and stand on a field and go, right, well, actually, this tokens I've got in my hand are related to the bit of earth that sat beneath my feet. And it could well be that it's something that's such a good idea that it's going to take off like a mushroom, you know, and that it, because then we can literally buy back, you know, bits of the earth and set them free and create community from it.
It'll certainly be great to have another currency that we can pass between ourselves. What's the mechanism by which it kind of enters our hands and stuff? How does it work?
Well, it's interestingly enough, I've got a meeting on Tuesday with the Green Party councillor in Glastonbury, who's an expert on alternative currencies. And so what we've got is we've got some idealistic ideas of how it might work, but what we're now doing is going to an expert to talk about how we might implement them. So on a basic principle, we're going to be able to distribute them at the next event at the gate, or at the Love Bank, we called it, where basically anything that you exchange on site at the next event, you would only be able to use Earth Pounds to do it. So whether it's buying something from the cafe or making a trade with someone that's doing healing. And so we'll only have the flow of our own currency on site. And what we're potentially thinking about doing is declaring an independent state of unity so that when you come in through the gate, you're no longer on the Queen's land. But that's taking it another step, you know, because obviously if you've got our own currency, and we've got our own jurisdiction and we're responsible for ourselves, then there is no law of the land. We are the law of the land. So there's some interesting experiments coming through anyway.
That'll be fascinating, that will, because, I mean, there are already some... I mean, I know there's already some pretty successful local currencies about. I've never had a chance to use one myself, but it'll be good, won't it, to talk to somebody who knows about it, because... clearly, there's already a lot of experience out there.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense to work with people that know what they're doing. You know, it just does. He's had loads of time and energy put into it over the years, and you know, he's worked with Letts and Time Banks, and you know, there was a currency set up by Sunrise. At the off-grid festivals, you know, that was a paper currency, and they've experimented with that. So, yeah, I mean, we're just going to take it forward slowly, slowly. Again, we're not, you know, there is no mad rush, but if it becomes popular, then obviously it will naturally gather the energy into itself and move forwards.
And let's face it, anything's got to be better than the currency we've got at the moment.
Oh, God. Let's not talk about that.
That's great. Look, I'll tell you what, we've been chatting for an hour or so, so I'll put on 10 minutes of uplifting tunes for people to listen to. We can have a bit of a comfort break and then come back for some more.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. So thanks to Sunbird there. We'll be back with you in 10 minutes or so. In the meantime, here are some tunes. There you go, that was Heal the Last Stand. And Smile, being good to people is as simple as a smile. Before that, of course, Doctor and the Medics. And before that, another Doctor Rock favourite, Kidnap Alice. I'm going where the chilly winds don't blow. Don't we just believe it? So we've still got Sunbird on the line with us. Thanks for coming back, Sunbird.
Hi there.
Hi there. I was intrigued to hear that you take your project over to Europe and do touring. What, I've been to a couple of fairly crazy gigs in Spain myself. What's it like working over there? What sort of stuff do you do there?
Well, I love it, to be honest with you, because by being abroad, it feels like we're on holiday, even though we're doing the same thing. I don't quite know how it works. But, you know, the weather's slightly better, and they love us out there, because, you know, in Britain, obviously, you know, festivals have just become so popular. And in Europe, we do it a bit differently to the way they do it over there. So, yeah, they, you know, we go down really well. And primarily, we've been working as the chill-out space at trance festivals.
Oh, that sounds like a good thing. I've always associated you with a fair amount of kicking sounds, actually.
Yeah, well, we do have the occasional party, you know, and I mean, I've done all sorts over the years, you know, I've done a lot of live music in the space as well. But through running the dance area at Sunrise Festival, I got into holding the chill out space, and my friend that used to run in Spiral stopped doing it. And so now we're probably the country's leading chill out called the Earth Heart. And, I mean, I love it. Just going on the road, I've got a fantastic team of people. You know, we do all sorts of crazy stuff, you know, and it's like a 1,000-piece jigsaw, but all the pieces are big and heavy, you know. And, when it's all put together, it's quite fun. It's in the shape of a big, big dragon, and they love it. You know, people just really get inspired by what we do.
Oh, brilliant. That's almost good enough to get my passport renewed.
Well, they certainly know how to party in Europe. There's none of this turn the music down at midnight or any of that business, you know.
No, that was certainly true of the gigs I went to in Spain, where we ended up kind of camping next to three white vans, basically, that were banging out Euro trance music 24 hours a day. It was completely relentless, but after about 36 hours or so, it kind of got into my blood, and I went along at the end of the gig and thanked them for it. And I think they thought I was taking the piss. They got quite angry to start with, but I really had learned something from it.
Yeah, well, sometimes you do have to surrender to what's going on and just get into it, you know.
I really think that's part of the key, actually. I do. You know, I can personally now sleep next to any amount of noise when I need to sleep. It doesn't make any difference to me. Having said that, I must admit the music that was coming out of the Earth Heart Cafe at the Unity was absolutely fantastic. I loved the variety, and all of it was great, I thought. I didn't hear anything that I didn't like. I didn't hear anything I recognised either.
Well, we had some friends come along, and they did play quite an eclectic mix of all sorts, from reggae through dub to a bit of, you know, drum and bass, which isn't necessarily my favourite, but they did mix it up enough that you couldn't really, you know, take offence to what was being played. Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, it was good, upbeat, fun, dancey music. Yeah, people seemed to enjoy it.
And it did seem to be the drum and bass, like you say, it's not one of my favourites either, but it was interesting stuff, you know.
Like everything, if it's done well, then it's good music. Even punk rock, you know, again, not something I would necessarily go out of my way to listen to, but actually in the right circumstances and done with passion, then of course it's, you know, it's going to hit the spot.
Yes, yeah, there's a few cracking punk tunes I like to play for sure. Perhaps next time I'll get a chance to spend a little bit, pay a bit more attention to what's going on. I seem to be kept pretty well entertained outside the dance spaces for the whole thing, so my ignorance was maintained even whilst I was enjoying it. Of course, we have got, as I said, we got Libby Laws, who did a breakfast set on Sunday, and she's been seconded onto MSI and now does a hippie punk show every week for us, and she's really great. That's a bit of an education.
Cool. Yeah. No, she was really enthusiastic, actually, you know, kind of put her best foot forwards and more or less insisted that she was going to play. And I'm glad she did. Yeah, she pulled it off, that's for sure.
Yeah, and she's, of course, one of the coordinators now as well, isn't she? Because she's stepped a little bit into the graphic design and marketing position.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, you know, we don't ever turn anybody away. You know, as long as they're passionate about what they do and they actually do it,
yeah.
then that all help is gratefully received, you know.
Yeah, indeed. It was really grand because she came along to that last meeting as well. When we all ended up, just for the folks out there, we ended up going out onto, is it Burrow Mump?
Yeah,
but it's a kind of a folly church on top of a big steep hill, and we went and made a 15 individual human heart on the side of the hill at some point. Actually, I'll do that, and I'll post the photograph into the photos section at MSI so people can see it. Sean McGuire's just put in the punk poet, he's just put in there, nothing wrong with punk rock.
Of course not. No, I wasn't saying there was anything wrong with punk rock, but it's the fact that, you know, that everybody's got their personal flavour. Unfortunately, we don't all like the same thing, but it's all about quality. You know, almost anything done with passion and quality in mind, almost anything, can be appreciated by almost everybody, you know.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. So what about this new project of yours, the Honour Our Mother Earth? What have you got in mind there? You see, developing several things at once here.
Yeah, well, it kind of came as a bit of a download. You know, it's almost as though once TLC was up and running and it's found its feet, it was as though some of the principles have been proved to work, like the membership aspects of it and some of the, you know, the co-ownership things and stuff. And so, you know, home, Honour Our Mother Earth, but home is where the heart is. Home is, you know, the earth itself. And there's a sense that, you know, that I create what I believe I want to be a part of. And so for me, what the Home Project is an umbrella organisation that is managing several projects that are all under the jurisdiction of the fact that they're in honour of the earth and the people and the relationship with those people. And so the projects that are coming up so far is a green dragon's den style TV program that's using crowdfunding to support all sorts of projects. And that's got the interest of the creative director of the Eden Project and Buzzbank and Positive TV. So there's quite some big players coming in on the concept of that. And then there's the Home Dance, which is a collaboration dance event between Sunrise, Glade and Waveform and potentially some others. And so the idea is to create a membership organisation so people can join in with this thing. They become members, you know, and it's probably going to have an affiliate scheme with things like TLC and Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth and all these other organisations. But the idea is that it's a solution-based organisation. And so a bit like your radio show, it's identifying things that are part of the solution and then it's finding ways in which to empower them, whether that's with energy from people, whether it's with money, whether it's with, you know, gathering different organisations together. And the other side of it is that sometimes these organisations are things that you never actually meet each other. So the idea is to put the TV show, the events, and the membership all as part of one thing. So it's possible to actually, on the ground, meet the people that you're networking with over the internet. And then one of the other main projects is Homeland. And that would ideally be a hub centre where some people live, where food is grown, where potentially things like TLC, you know, can come and hold their events. And, you know, the TV show can be filmed and different things. And so the vision is quite big, but because it's based around the ability to promote small projects that are part of a bigger project, it's going to be a thing that kind of snowballs and grows quite rapidly. And the underpinning idea is that as we create it, we're doing it from the bottom up through crowdfunding. So there's literally just an idea, and then we're going to crowdfund the idea, and then from that we're going to crowdfund the different projects that are related to the idea, and in such a way that we're going to create a manual so that if someone in Slovenia or Africa or South America is so inspired, they can follow our lead and do exactly the same thing where they are. So it's like a way of again, giving people the ability to respond, the responsibility to create some solutions for themselves and to empower them.
That's really great, because it also means that, once again, it means that people can be given a chance to have a fair crack of the whip without having to make all of the expensive decisions you've had to make over the last sort of 12, 14 years or so.
Yeah, well, I think in some ways that we're entering the age where it's all about people power. You know, I mean, there's the Avaaz petition thing. You know, it's 25 million people. Whenever did 25 million people all become part of one thing? You know, it's only happened now with modern technology and the fact that people are starting to realize that if they don't care, nobody cares, you know. And so we're entering that phase, and we can't rely on the banks and big business to invest in the right things. So we're going to have to do it ourselves, you know. And I think, you know, responsibility, again, you know, our call to actually make a difference. And most people that I know, you know, and I believe most people, the majority of humanity, if they could make a difference, would make a difference. If they felt that they could do something that was, that would help change the world, they'd do it. And it's only because we're feeling disempowered that, you know, in many ways, that the progress is slow. And I suppose part of my dream for the Home Project is that it will take off in lots of different countries, and it will have a cumulative effect on inspiring people that they can, you know, do something to make a change that has a bigger impact than just the small thing that they alone do.
Yeah, I guess it's like, it's like, as we've said, the moment's always all right, and the fear comes from anticipation or memory. In my experience as well, people are fundamentally beyond decent. People are really generous and friendly by and large.
Yeah. Yeah, well, without wanting to go into details of that too much, you know, I think if we hadn't been playing out a game that's set by a small number of people on the planet, I think we'd be in a much better position. But we've got to, you know, we've got to work with what is, not what we'd like to be. And considering the situation is that we know that we're facing a certain set of challenges. And the key is to identify the solutions, empower them and put energy into them. And if I do that and you do that and someone in Australia does that and people all over the world start to kind of activate in that way, and we find tools like this mechanism of promoting crowdfunding ideas that people can put forwards. As I say, I'm quite inspired by this, you know, this Green Dragon's Den TV kind of format where instead of it being to make someone richer, it's for the greater good. I think it could make some really, really good television. And, you know, and again, television, there's as much good stuff as there is bad stuff, and billions of people are watching it. So it makes sense to use that medium, but to reach out with something positive.
It's one of the things that I've thought for a long time is that television could easily be one of the most useful tools we've got if you could change the quality of what was on it.
Yeah. Isn't that true?
And yeah. That is an exciting idea, that that sort of environmental or green dragon's den, where we give give people a chance to come up with ideas, and I suppose have them kind of not examined, have them questioned by people who've got experience in these things. That's a very interesting idea.
Yeah, well, I think that's the concept, is to, for people, and we're actually putting out for people that have got you know, ideas based on there's certain categories. There's sustainability, health, education, enterprise and science, I think, are the 5-6 that we're going with at the moment. But people that have got ideas of things that are for the greater good, fitting into any one of those categories, can put it forwards as if it's, you know, an enterprise idea for Dragon's Den. And we're going to be shortlisting people. And what they'll be able to do is present their idea to a panel of people that will have experts. There'll be scientists. There'll be entrepreneurs. You know, I quite fancy myself as one of the panelists. You know, but there'll be half a dozen people, you know, that they'll present their idea to. And if the panel likes the idea, then we're going to create an advert and put it out to the general populace, you know, so that for funding. And we're going to, I think the plan is to run it like a Top of the Pops style thing. So there's going to be a whole range of different projects, and every week they're going to be raising funds, and the ones that are at the top and you know, that are getting enough money are going to be brought onto the show and given a pat on the back, basically, you know. And you know, and we're going to film people activating their projects, and I envisage it being, you know, successful enough that someone could step forwards with a water engine, show us running it on television, and raise as much money as necessary as to put it on the market. You know, or alternative power systems, or cures for cancer. I mean, who knows? There is no limit to this mechanism.
And we know that all of those things are out there. That really all they need to be is... all they need to be is de-sidelined.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it could easily become mainstream, this thing, where people realise, that the 99% thing, you know, if there's 8 billion people on the planet, and there's only 1% of the people that are, you know, seeking to gravitate all the resources for themselves, well, the other 7.5 billion people are a massive movement, you know. And if we decide to start taking action together as a collective, which I believe is the future, that we start to realize unity consciousness, and then from that start to act differently towards each other, then things like this are the exact kind of tools, this and the Earth Pound and the community gatherings. These are all the tools we're going to need for self-reliance.
And change could happen quite quickly on that basis, couldn't it? Because it's already a wave rising.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's all about formulas. You know, if you get a formula right, like the way we're planning things is to mirror nature. So nature, when it's a sunny day, it reproduces cells in plants by the billion. If you look at a field of grass, there's billions and billions of cells being created on a sunny day. You know, it doesn't have to think about it. It's the mechanism is in place and it just gets on with the job, you know. And I mean, I personally believe that 2012 was all about the turning of the tide, that the epoch that we were in, that the Mayans mapped, was all about the cycle of separation. And we came to the end of the cycle of separation on winter solstice last year. And we've now entered the cycle of integration and unity. And so just as the tide goes to the point where it's the furthest out, as long as the tide's coming back in, it's coming back in. You don't have to rush it in. You can't make it come in quicker than it is. As long as it's coming in and you know it's coming in, you can prepare for it and be part of that process. And yeah, that's what I believe is happening, is, you know, where the truth of reality is dawning on everybody, and we're either choosing to acknowledge it or we're not. And those that are choosing to acknowledge it are starting to take action that is in alignment with that understanding.
Yes, you know, I agree. I feel something fundamentally changed on 2012, and I know we're not alone there. I know that some people seem to think that it was a bit of a damp squib, but, you know, you can... I mean, if nothing else, I'd say that the festivals I went to this year were absolutely excellent. They were... I've been going to festivals for many years, and they were the most joyful and peaceful and well-sorted events that I've ever attended. And, you know, if they're an example of a general movement, then so much the better.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, the danger is to pay attention too much to the mainstream media and think that that's what's happening in the world. And the truth is, nearly everybody today had a good day. Nearly everyone.
Yeah.
You know, they made the most of it. People have an innate ability to make the most of their lot. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're in India or South America or wherever, you know. And so the key is somehow having faith that the divine plan is in action, and that we're a part of it, and that we've just got to do our best and trust that everybody else is doing the same. And the more we can do that, the more we're part of the solution. You know, the problem is that when we fear the worst and then stay attached to that fear, then we're not part of the solution, we're part of the problem, because we're just giving energy to that which we don't want to happen again, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah, yes, indeed. And it is a gradual thing, isn't it? It's just a little bit at a time. And I'm always reminded of that yin and yang symbol of the kind of the two little fishies, one of them black with a white dot and the other one white with a black dot. And it makes me think that, you know, there comes a point in the cycle, which is what the Maya were measuring, when shadow is at its maximum, and when, if you like, your little white dot gets to be only one pixel. But the little white dot's never going to disappear, and once it's got to one pixel, it's going to go to 2, then 4, then 8, then 16. And that process is going to carry on until there's only one pixel of shadow left. And I think we're definitely in the upswing now.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And there was an element, wasn't there, of this kind of world cooperation at the Unity, because weren't we all playing the same music at some point?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, I think that the key at Unity is that there is a sense of unity, that even though we're separate beings, you know, I think that actually what's starting to happen is there's a tangibility to the fact that we are interacting, and that we're like, I like the analogy that we're fish in a fishbowl, and the paradigm of thinking that we're separate is like a fish thinking that it's not made of water.
Yeah.
No amount of thinking you're not made of water makes it true. Because it's a complete and utter illusion. You know, we are in the earth, not on the earth, you know, and that we are part of each other. And there's nothing we can do about that. And so the illusion of separateness is exactly that, you know. And, you know, it's interesting to see how that bubble will burst and how easily we're going to find our way around it, you know.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. So, and I think that it sounds to me that's really brilliantly expressed visionary intent there is something that, you know, the work you've already done is like the kernel at the centre of it, isn't it, really? It's not like it's a completely new thing. It's like it can be grown from the experience, all the experience that you and your various contacts have already got.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's, I mean, that's what everybody's always doing, but it's interesting that some of the super challenging situations that I've had in the past has led me towards coming up with solutions for my own personal problems of how to share responsibility for creating events. And then from that, thinking, well, what can we do to create more than just events? You know, how can we broaden that? How can we live together? How can we support solutions? You know, how can I make a lasting difference with the short time that I've got here, you know? And I think that I read something the other day that everybody would love to feel that their life has a purpose. And it's just, you know, finding a way of helping people realize what their personal gifts are, you know. And everybody's got a gift for the world. It's just that most people aren't sure what it is.
And we can all be helpful giving other people the context in which they can survive or live fruitfully, can't we?
Absolutely, yeah.
And that, as we say, comes about as a result of concentrating on the small achievable things that we seem to be good at, you know, which can be partly defined by the things that happen easily for us and the things that we seem to get synchronistic help for, rather than spending a lot of time banging our head against a wall trying to make something happen that isn't happening easily. I mean, it might be just a matter of leaving that thing for a couple of months and giving it another go, but going with the flow, doing the stuff which appears to be unfolding around us, rather than doing just what we think might be right, seems to work a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that it's a shame that we're not taught to follow our bliss and our true calling at school. But unfortunately, that's not good business. You know,
no.
Creates free thinkers.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're taught how to obey orders and to, you know, want to go to work, unfortunately.
Yeah, one of my favourite people is a character now dead called Joseph Campbell. I don't know whether you've heard of him. He's a kind of he had an interest in the myth of the sort of what are called the Native Americans. I'm not sure what the politically correct description for them is. As a very young man, and that developed over his entire life. I think he lived till he was in his middle 80s. To a love of myth globally, he spent his time looking especially at myths that arose apparently independently in many different places on the earth. And he said that when his students asked him for advice, the piece of advice he always gave them was follow your bliss, because he said then doors will open for you that wouldn't open otherwise, and in fact doors will open for you that just wouldn't be there for other people. It's certainly been my experience that that doing that does seem to work out.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, you know, when we face our fears and kind of open up and flower, we give everybody around us permission to do the same, you know. And it's through the courage of being our true selves and facing our demons and our challenges, you know, and coming out the other side and people seeing us, you know. The most inspiring thing is when you see somebody that looks really happy and has obviously got something, and you automatically want what they've got. You know, if you're feeling low and you see someone that's vibrant and full of life, then that's the most inspiring thing that you can come across, you know.
Yeah, and we can't really have any doubt as to the power that we have, that our activities and behaviour have on other people anymore, because I've been for some time now watching stuff develop on the placebo effect, and it seems absolutely undeniable, really, that the way your doctor approaches you can make the difference between life or death.
Yeah.
And of course it's a shared thing, because it's also the way you approach your doctor and all that kind of stuff. But words and behaviour are really powerful.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Well, that's exactly it, isn't it? I mean, it's all about belief, and it seems a shame that spirituality is in the hands of monolithic religions. You know, whereas I think it, you know, without some belief in a greater force other than just the mechanics of atoms moving about, I think that it's a, you know, it's very difficult to get a sense that there is some kind of cosmic order of things. And I think most people have become materialistic rather than atheistic. You know, and the trouble is with things is you can't fill your spirit up with things because they're impermanent outer constructs. You know, even a new car is only nice for a few weeks and then you realise it's just another car, you know.
And it does seem to be the case that having everything doesn't necessarily make you any happier.
Yeah, it's true enough.
And it's all about, it's a matter of flowing, isn't it? Like water, which is another of your main interests, isn't it? In fact, it seems to have been a lifelong enthusiasm of yours.
Yeah. Yeah, well, somehow, I feel lucky that I'm passionate about what I do and that I'm inspired and I feel that I am a part of a bigger picture. And I'm, you know, I'm eternally grateful for that because I do find myself with unending amounts of energy and I wake up enthusiastic and I crack on, you know, and I've got no doubt into knowing where to put my energy, whereas, you know, many people don't have that luck.
Yeah, and it's great to wake up in the morning full of the stuff you're going to be doing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So do you want to talk to us a little bit about your mission to find the perfect cup of tea? Because it has to be said that one of the reasons why I probably didn't necessarily notice the absence of a bar at the Unity was because of the quality of the chai coming out of your cafe.
Yeah, well.
And you have got that outrageous water delivery system that hangs above it all. And that was there right back at the Earth Height. You've obviously been carrying that around for over a decade now.
Yeah, I kind of came up with that in Israel. God, yeah, about 14 years ago. And it was, I was a marine engineer originally, and I did a 5-year apprenticeship, had my own business for 5 years, and then realized that money and things weren't going to make me happy, and I kind of got out of that. It was the whole story related to it, and then basically went off traveling and found myself in a teepee community in Spain. And after some time of, you know, sitting under the proverbial tree and meditating and connecting into nature and different things, I realized I needed a purpose in life. And I actually decided to make the perfect cup of tea. And it seemed like a simple thing, you know, at the time. But I figured, well, if I focus on doing that and I get really good at that, then at least I'm really good at something. Because I had a sense that I wasn't really good at anything. And basically, it just became a ridiculous obsession. And so I suppose what you see in the Earth Heart these days is the best I can possibly make it. Because what I realized was that once you've got organic ingredients and you know, then what can you affect? And I realized that what I can affect is the quality of the water. And so the Earth Heart is actually the spiralizer, you know, double Merkava copper tube system that you see in the middle there. And what it does is it anchors light into water. And so I don't know if you've come across the Masaru Emoto water crystals.
Certainly have.
So he, some years later, proved the fact that you can affect the crystalline structure of water by, you have the same water bottle and you can write love and hate on the two bottles, and the crystals that come out of the two, the frozen crystals put under a dark field microscope that come out of the two bottles have got a completely different shape. The love one is in symmetry and the hate one is distorted.
The power of the written word, eh?
Well, more than that, it's the fact that water responds to the energy that it interacts with. And so, interestingly, it's my theory that emotions are this crystalline structure of your water changing. And so we respond to our surroundings with emotions. And so the emotions are literally our water crystals changing structure inside our bodies. That's what an emotion is. And I mean, that, you know, that's a little bit of a tangent, but back to the water system. So the idea is that we make a circle around it and we turn it on, and we literally create a pillar of light that goes from the center of the earth to the source of all light in the center of the universe. And then we put water through the spiraling system, and it gathers energy. And I suppose the idea is that it creates a beautiful crystal shape, you know, if you look at the Emoto stuff. And so by feeding light into water and then making it with the top ingredients that you possibly can, and then having intention when you make it, what happens with the chai is that it's programmed to, with the light that's in it, go to the darkness within your body. And so you automatically feel better.
Yeah.
And it is like the perfect cup of tea.
Yeah.
You know? And to some extent, your mum making you a nice cup of normal builder's tea with love and giving it to you when you're feeling a bit down is kind of the same thing, but on a more simple scale, because she's giving it to you from love and she's put all her love and intention into it. And when she's stirring it, she's making sure all the sugar's dissolved. You know, that every intention we can do with every drink, everything that we do, and it has an effect, you know. And obviously we've just learned how to do it on a grand scale.
Yeah, I really love that device, because I know from reading Schauberger's work that making water spin does bring it back to life. It does restore energy to it. And I do a lot of work myself with human energy fields and geometry. And the star tetrahedron, or the Merkaba as it's otherwise known, is another tremendously powerful form, because it effectively represents the mother of form meeting the father of consciousness, or energy and matter melding. And so by spiraling water through the middle of the star tet, you really are. And it's got, in the middle of the star tet, you've got an octahedron, which is representative of not only air, but of prana and all other subtle energy systems as well. So I can only see it helping putting the water through all of that. You went through quite an adventure collecting water as well, didn't you? I caught the very beginning of your water talk only, because I got called away to do a bit of crewing of some sort. So that's the, I went away. What, can you remind me what you did to?
Well, yeah, I mean, at the community that I told you about, I ended up becoming clairaudient to, and being able to kind of communicate with the spirit of a spring there. And it encouraged me to go to surrounding springs in the area. It was in the Sierra Nevada, so there's hundreds of springs in the area. And to take water from it to these springs and bring water back. And in the process of doing that, I started to learn about the nature of water. And that actually was what led me on to making the perfect cup of tea thing, I suppose. You know, because then I had this energized water, then I made tea, and then I made normal tea, and then, you know, so then it got more and more complicated. Okay. But basically, because I'm somehow good at networking and empowering people to go and do things, I've ended up getting all sorts of people into water bearing, and it works on the homeopathic principle. So as long as I keep a wet edge, the water goes through the bottle, but I don't need to contain thousands of different bottles. It's all collected together, like a hard drive of a computer.
Yeah, exactly right.
And so now it's got water from more than 10,000 places around the world, all the seas on the planet. And interestingly, one of the teachings that's come from it is that there is only one drop of water on the planet. And there is all the seas, all the lakes, rivers, humans, animals, all the trees. And so in the age where we're becoming aware of unity consciousness and that we're made of water, then actually the unity of all life within water is a tangible way of relating to that unity consciousness.
Yes. Yeah, because that's another thing, isn't it? Is that the homeopathic thing you're referring to is this idea that water never forgets. That you can put even quite a large molecule into water and then dilute it 100,000 times or whatever, and it still somehow maintains the energy of that molecule, even though there's never any chance of finding it in there.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's nature's perfect battery and hard drive memory system, you know. And it's very clever how it works. I mean, it's beyond our ability to understand from a human perspective. But I still think it's an amazing tool, you know. It's one of those things that just by honouring it and connecting with it, it can change the whole... your whole day, or the way in which you live your life, you know, by drinking good water and drinking enough of it is something that's so important that many people don't, you know. The majority of humanity is actually dehydrated. And what we don't get taught is that the body that's hydrated, that's got enough water flowing through it, is obviously at ease. And the moment there isn't enough water coming through it regularly, it's on a kind of semi-alert. And so how can it possibly be healthy if it's feeling starved of something that is so essential, like water? You know, and obviously we mix up coffee and tea and Coke and any other liquids that we stick down our necks, and we think they're water. Even juices that are made from concentrate, they're not. They don't act as water in the body. You know, the body actually takes so much energy and liquids to try and sort them out that they can dehydrate you, you know.
Yeah, because it treats them all as foods, doesn't it?
Exactly, you know. And, I mean, there's all sorts of scientific stuff about the colloids in water and the energy of it, you know. And if you get water that's got the right energy, it doesn't reach your stomach, it just gets absorbed straight into your bloodstream. Whereas if you go and you get water from a tap, you know, you can feel it. If you drink a pint of water from the tap, you can feel it land in your stomach and slosh about. And I describe it in some of my talks that water from a spring is like a snake, you know, and it's got that living quality of a snake. And water from a pipe, you know, from a tap that's pressurized, it's still snake, but it's like snake that's been put through a mincer. So minced snake and snake that's living, they're both snake, but one has got a very different energetic quality to the other.
Yeah, well, I've finally got around to filtering. We actually got access to, we don't have fluoride in our water out here, which is really helpful. And mostly I get to drink water from boreholes, but actually we've got a guest coming on next Thursday who's a bit of a specialist on this sort of thing and is going to be talking to us on things we can do to our water. But she was doing a talk at the Unity, in fact, and it was listening to her that convinced me eventually and finally to actually get a charcoal filter to start putting my water through. And it does taste a lot better. And also, I had myself, I used to get these cluster headaches, clusters of really, really serious headaches that used to come completely randomly. And sometimes there'd be huge gaps between them, you know, maybe a year and a half or 2 years. And then they'd come in little bundles. And I eventually came across this idea that it doesn't happen to everybody, but with me it was symptomatic of chronic dehydration. And so I've started drinking water regularly at the beginning, at the end of the day. And whilst admittedly I might be in one of those gaps between these experiences, it's been a long time since I've had any now. And I do feel a lot better for it as well.
Absolutely. I mean, something that you might want to consider doing just on that note is a liver flush, because a lot of headaches are caused by toxicity in the liver. And in fact, if you're looking to have the the most effect from the minimum amount of extra water in your life, the best time to drink as much water as possible is before anything else in the morning.
Yeah, that's what I do, basically.
Yeah. Wake up and drink as much as you can. I mean, you know, there's a whole kind of theory of urine therapy and all of that, but this is not the time to go into that. But if over the period of 28 days, every day you drink half a pint to a pint of water, and better that it's body temperature than cold, then at the end of that 28 days, your body memory starts to think that you're going to do it for the rest of your life. And so it starts to organize all the toxins in your body in a different way while you're sleeping, because it knows it's going to get flushed out with fresh water and not a coffee and a cigarette in the morning.
Yeah.
And yeah. And that can really alleviate the build-up, you know, the backup in the system of toxins.
Oh, it's good to hear, because that's basically what I do now. I mean, it's quite funny, actually, because to start with, that sort of habit developed because it got to the point where I was actually looking at the milk I was having in the tea and thinking that I didn't really want the milk anymore. I realised I was drinking the tea because mostly because I suspect I was after the sugar or honey I was having in it. And then I realised that the cheap tea we were drinking is apparently a really great source of fluoride because it concentrates itself in the leaves. And I also realised that at the time it was a time of even more advanced penury than usual, that actually it'd be a lot cheaper not to be buying the sugar and the tea and the milk either. So I started drinking the water, and it's been going on for a while now. I think for the last two or three couple of months, maybe a bit more, I've been drinking 2 pints of slightly above blood temperature water in the morning.
Right.
And it seems to reduce hunger as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're made of water. You know, there's a book that I read years ago called The Body's Many Cries for Water. And it says that actually the body cries out for water and we eat or smoke a cigarette. And it goes, no, water, and we eat again and have more cigarette.
Or
a sweet, you know, bit of chocolate. And it's like, no, water. And of course it can't speak to us in the form of what it really wants. It just gives us a craving, you know. And so we're responding to dehydration with things that are dry.
Yeah. So we're confusing our body's own symptoms, requirements.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, we're made of water, you know. The amount of mud in the water of your body is relatively small, you know. It's interestingly enough, something that I discovered was that it's a slightly more water in a man than there is a woman, strangely. But the rough percentage, about 73%, is the same percentage as the surface of the Earth, which is an interesting coincidence.
Ah, it's a holographic place, isn't it?
So there's about 73% surface of the Earth, about 73% of our body is water. So if you think it's 100 kilos, well, that's 73 litres of water.
Yeah.
Maybe we're not 100 kilos, I don't know, what am I, maybe 60 kilos or something, but you know, that's an awful lot of water in there.
But that book you mentioned, The Body's Many Cries for Water, was that the guy who found himself in a Russian prison or something, and he was a doctor, and he had people coming to him with all manner of grief, and all he had to give them was water?
He didn't have anything else to use to fix them. Yeah, so he healed them through water, and I think I think it's also related to urine therapy as well, that, you know, it's the information in your urine as much as anything that can actually help you unlock some of the stuck-in toxins in your body, you know. Because contrary to popular belief, urine isn't full of toxins. It's actually very pure, and it's full of vitamins and minerals and amino acids and things.
Yeah, this is what I've heard. I'd also heard that that you don't need to drink it, that actually just a sort of spoonful under the tongue for a while works as a sort of homeopathic basis.
Yeah, or even just dipping your finger in a running pea and putting it on the glands that are either side of the stringy bit in the bottom of your tongue, and your glands can pick up one part in a million of anything. They're like the super sensory glands, and they're there because your body's trying to sense what is going on and what's coming into it, you know. And it's, that's a whole subject in and of itself, you know. I mean, it's something that I practice and I find that it's very healthy, you know, but it's something you've got to get your head around, that's for
you,
sure.
You certainly look good on it. And I did try it myself for a while as well, but I'm happier drinking the water. Something else that I think probably helps us, because I have actually done the liver and kidney flush and things like that, but every year, we've just finished doing it, in fact, every year we've got access to an apple press. And right. So we make tens of gallons of apple juice, which right. in order to make it keep, we pasteurize it. But in the 3 or 4 or 5 days that we spend doing it, we drink loads of it as it comes out the bottom of the press.
Right.
And I'm told that apple juice is really good at softening all of the various stones and things in it. Softens your bile ducts and all of that so that absolutely. Everything can move on.
Yeah. I mean, something else that's really good is cider vinegar. Now, I personally don't like the taste of cider vinegar. So someone the other day introduced me to a recipe where you put honey, lemon and ginger with cider vinegar, and it acts as an alkaline in your body, which is obviously really good because most of the things we eat are acid forming, but it also dissolves the build up of calcium and minerals, because again we're so mineral rich, you know, whether it's through the water or through, you know, through things that we eat. I'm not saying about trace nutrients of vitamins necessarily, but minerals. Often the waters we drink are very mineral heavy, you know, and I'm in Glastonbury, and often, the spring waters there are very, very mineral heavy. And if you're not careful, that can actually end up clogging up your system, you know, like sediment in a river. And, so getting cider vinegar, you know, as I say, with this honey and lemon mix with ginger is a really good way. Again, it's one of those drinks in the morning. It has the best effect because you start your day off with an alkalizing effect, you know.
Yeah. Synchro made this year, she made some blackberry cordial, which was, as well as the blackberry and sugar, there was, it was mostly vinegar.
Right.
And so it did taste a bit vinegary. The first one I had, I didn't really like it very much, and I did put some lemon and ginger in it. But actually, this is another interesting thing, I think, is that, because I did have a bit of a cold, and so it really did seem to make a difference to that. But fairly quickly, after 5 or 6 days of drinking this stuff, I no longer needed to add anything to it. My body seemed to realise that it was good for it, and so it stopped me objecting to drinking it.
Interesting, yeah. It's funny that, isn't it? It's like I remember my first beer, my first lager. It was horrible. I couldn't work out why it was so popular.
Yeah.
And then, of course, especially when you're young, you know, you soon overcome that and to the point where you actually enjoy the flavour. So yeah. It is about a matter of familiarity, you know. Yeah.
So what sort of places did you go to then? Where? Because you say you became clairaudient at this spring. Is that something that's continued?
I mean, like many things in my life, they go through different phases. And so sometimes I get really into something for a period and I, you know, hone my skills on it. And then I end up getting distracted into a different area, you know, and I'm just kind of filling my tool bag with different things. But yeah, I'm still able to tune into the sound of water and connect, you know, and I've always had a good, well, not always, but for years I've had a good connection to my spirit guides, and I'm able to kind of connect to, you know, to them for guidance and things like that, which is always really helpful, you know, as opposed to just listening to my inner mind. But yeah, I mean, it's taken me all over the world. You know, I've collected thousands from all over Europe, mainly. I spent quite a lot of time in Israel at a certain point. But as I say, along the way, what I've done is I've empowered water carriers. And so I've, you know, once I had a few, I was able to then say, look, you know, off you go with your bottle of water. You know, next time you see me, give me some back. And I've had some incredible stories along the way. You know, it's people getting really into it. And of course, it's the age of Aquarius, which is, you know, which is the age of water.
Yeah. What was it like? What was it like in Israel?
Amazing. Yeah, nothing, not at all like you'd expect it to be. You know, pretty much, I think everywhere, the people are lovely. The government's rubbish. The army's awful. You know, the politics are terrible. You know, the bigoted religion, you know, the monolithic religions that are kind of at each other's throats is just a travesty. But the people are lovely, you know. I had a great time there.
Right. Well, I think that's, have you got, where can, what have we got in mind for next year in terms of events? Are we going to see more Unity stuff happening?
Absolutely. The next, there's likely to be an indoor one for Spring Equinox. We're going to stick to the fire festivals and the equinoxes. Then the one after that is going to be Beltane. And that's the May bank holiday at the beginning of May. And then the one after that is going to be for the autumn equinox. So they're all being lined up. And then there's the chance of a thing called Home Dance, which is going to be a collaboration kind of, you know, celebration with a difference. And that's likely to take place in early September.
Okay. And what sort of collaboration do you have in mind for that?
Well, I'm talking to several space holders and festivals, including Waveform and Sunrise and possibly Bimbaline and, you know, Liquid Records and Origin Stage and different people that are capable of holding energy and looking at working together, collaborating in order to create something different, something new, you know. And again, it will be with ethics, so there'll be membership and it will be something to be a part of.
Very good. You said you had an indoor one for the spring equinox.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's Shepton Mallet. That'll be.
But what sort of indoor space is that? That sounds like an interesting idea.
It's a hired barn. It only takes a couple of hundred people, but I think that's enough. You know, again, just working on the smaller numbers and the dance celebration. It will probably be around 1,500. So It's big enough to get a vibe going, but not too big that you don't, you know, that you don't get to know everybody.
Yeah. And will people be camping for the spring one?
I think there's room for a few camper vans, but it's more likely to be an overnighter.
Okay.
Right.
The turn up and stay awake gig.
Absolutely.
Very good. So,
excellent.
Thank you very much for that, Sunbird. I really enjoyed it. And I hopefully Sean's been singing the praises of the Unity gig in the chat box as we've been going along. Hopefully we'll see a few more people there from MSI as a result, because they are really cracking places to come to. I'll stick the meetup.com TLC Society Events for People Who Care address into the chat box for anybody who wants to know any more.
Right.
And,
if anybody, any of the things that have come up, if anybody's, you know, wanting to get in touch with me directly, you know, then it's, earthheart, EARTHEART 2012@yahoo.com. That's my email address. You're welcome to get in touch, you know, if you're inspired or, you know, want to find out more about anything that we've been talking about, then, you've got my email address there, Nick. So, by all means, get in touch, and I'd be happy to hear from you.
Very good. Well, thank you very, very much for joining me. I enjoyed that talk, and I look forward to. I guess we'll be meeting up on Google Plus, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah, so in a few weeks' time.
I must admit that's still a complete mystery to me. I've been and looked at it a couple of times, wondering how to make it work. Had no experience of social networks at all. I'm quite mystified by it, but hopefully I'll get it sorted out by December when I need to.
I should have thought so. It's similar to Skype,
Yeah.
But I'm confident it'll all come together.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for that. I shall put on another two or three tunes and then and return to them before the end of the show. But thanks a lot, and perhaps we can have you back sometime later in the year when your Green Dragons done and stuff's going, and I'd love to hear more about, you know, how the meeting goes with the individual that knows about alternative currencies.
Great. Yeah, that sounds like a plan.
Brilliant. Okie dokie. Well, thank you very much. I'll stay in touch on the Skype now. I've got your number. And
okay.
I'll see you again soon.
Okay, thanks, Sim. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks a lot. Cheers, Sunbird.